ones who care about you, your real friends, those are the ones that will come up to you and whisper in your ear, thanks. I need to be in accumulation mode too. Okay, I think you get it. So let's put it into action. Here are the four key steps to stacking and racking cash during accumulation. Number one, you must focus on your money. Once you're out of broke, you can now stop having to cut spending completely. But be careful. You'll want to celebrate, to back off, to take your hand off the throttle. You must force yourself to not let this happen. What you focus on will get accomplished, and focusing on money when you are in accumulation is vital. Think of it like this. Remember when you were in school and you procrastinated on your term paper? The teacher gave out the assignment with plenty of time to complete it, but you and I waited and waited until the last minute to buckle down, focus on it, and finish. The result was often less than our best effort, poorly thought through, and most often a less than stellar grade. Perhaps you were that person who could wait until the last minute, pull the all-nighter, and still get an A. Well, good for you, but last-minute efforts won't help you in the wealth accumulation game. If you don't take the time to focus, plan, stack and rack, prepare, research, analyze, and then execute on your plan, you will end up with an F in retirement. And in retirement is where the real grades count. Number two, you must create a second bank account. Please listen carefully to me. You can't have just one bank account. You must have a minimum of two. Your first account will be your operating account. This is the account that will be used to pay your bills and nothing more. Your second account will be for every single other dollar. Stop mixing up your stack and rack cash with your operating account. Your money needs to be separated, because when your money is all in one place, you will spend it. The single biggest choice I made when I got out of broke and into accumulation was to employ this strategy. Because I'm self-employed, I was able to set up two accounts with our payroll company. I determined how much money I needed to cover my bills each month. We did this exercise already, and that became account one, called my operating account. Every other dollar above my bills went into my second account. I call it my reserve account. It became the account that held my money for future use. Your second account is not a secret stash or European vacation fund. It is isolated for a reason. It is not to be touched. You're in accumulation to get to rich. Number three, make more money. Here it is again. Saving can only get you so far. If you really want to accumulate your way to rich, you need to start earning more. Don't worry. We'll get to how later. Number four, upgrade your network. When you are in accumulation, you will need to move up the food chain with respect to the people you surround yourself with. The higher up the food chain you go, the more opportunities will come your way. The odds of getting rich by leaving your money in your bank account earning 0.05% interest are zero. It will not happen. If you want to get rich, you are going to have to make bigger moves. You are going to have to find and connect with people who support you and provide you opportunities. Now, you're probably asking, when does accumulation end? This is perhaps the most controversial part of this audio program. You can't even think about leaving accumulation mode until you have invested or have liquid assets of $5 million. That's right, $5 million. How did I come up with this amount? Easy. First, it is the result of the 1 times, 3 times, 5 times, 10 times formula. If you make $500,000 a year and you are in your 50s, you should have a $5 million net worth. I'm giving you the number of $5 million if you're looking for a hard one, but it might not necessarily be that for you. It's just a suggestion. What it does need to be is 10 times your annual income as your net worth, so that 10 times or 5 million can be placed into investment tools such as stocks, bonds, and treasuries, and you might be able to then achieve a 5% annual return. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't start investing sooner, because you should. But once you get to the point of having invested 5 million bucks with, let's just say, a 5% annual return, it will end up providing you with $250,000 per year before you touch your principal. I actually think you should start investing in mutual fund stocks and real estate when you have anywhere between $50,000 and $100,000 saved up. That's because only then have you reached the right mindset and momentum to get to the next phase of wealth. But back to the $250,000. That's not bad income for most people to live off of in retirement, but that's your choice. I'd say only then is someone out of accumulation, because that is 10 times the amount most Americans live on during retirement. Most people can live a nice life on $250,000 a year. It's not enough for me to live my lifestyle by design, but if you can get to $250,000 a year in passive income, you will be able to retire without worrying that you'll run out of money. But when you do get to that point, you'll find that you have the capacity to go even bigger. I remind you again of the principle of this audio program. I need more money. You need more money. We all need more money. Don't go easy on yourself. Push yourself to dream bigger and therefore live better in retirement. Every single person I know who actually has $5 million wishes they had more. Because for game facers, they know that if they can reach a major milestone like that, they can also reach higher. The power of I'm in accumulation mode. We've now established that most of us are in accumulation mode, especially if you're listening to this audio program. The ability to start using the statement, I'm in accumulation mode, will change your entire financial life, just like it did mine. This simple statement has removed all of the stigma, the guilt I had connected to saying no. Saying no to splurging on the latest phones and gadgets that in reality wreaked havoc on my future retirement. Saying no to trips for select soccer or lacrosse tournaments. Saying no to vacations to exotic places that would push me back years from achieving my lifestyle by design. Here is what I mean. The average cost for a family of four to go on an average trip to Disneyland is $5,000, including airfare, hotel, passes, and food. If that $5,000 is put away for 20 years at a 6% annual return, and you added only $100 per month to it, you would have $62,824 saved up. So don't tell me the children need a trip. Many families take their children to Disneyland when the kids are 5 and 7 years old. Trust me, they would be just as happy taking a road trip to the beach or to a fishing cabin in the woods at that age. Put it off 1 year and you will have saved the $5,000 from that year in today's dollars and almost $63,000 in tomorrow's dollars. Now, let's get really serious. If you put off the Disney trip for 2 years, that means you saved the $5,000 from 2 years ago of not going to Disneyland in your retirement account wisely, and instead spent a new $5,000 on your deprived children when they are 7 and 9 years old, you will end up saving $78,800 in your retirement account. That makes saying we can't go this year, we are in accumulation mode, far less painful, doesn't it? By putting off the Disneyland trip for just 2 years, you will have an extra $78,800. The beautiful part of being in accumulation mode is that your worst fears won't come true. Maybe you're afraid that your friends won't want to hang out with you, or that your status in the community will be lowered. You're afraid of being knocked off your pedestal. You're afraid you'll disappoint your spouse if you don't plan an elaborate vacation for the two of you. Nothing could be further from the truth. When I made the decision to define the three stages of wealth as broke, accumulation, and rich, I went into accumulation mode, hook, line, and sinker. I started by telling my wife, we are not broke, but we are not rich yet. We are in accumulation mode. This simple statement, along with the funding of my reserve account, have been the two most important decisions I have ever made in building wealth. Reserve account. Perhaps the most important strategy to achieve my financial success has been the creation and execution of a reserve account. I mentioned this a few times before, and now I'm going to tell you exactly how it works. Keeping my mind in a constant state of brokenness while stacking and racking cash has made all the difference. I created two bank accounts in my life. The first account is what I call the household or operating account. You probably already have this account. It's your normal checking account at your bank. Your paycheck is deposited into this manually or via direct deposit each pay period. The second account is called the reserve account. This account, as you will quickly see, will become one of the single best decisions you have ever made. I have used two bank accounts for more than 15 years in both my personal and business life, and it has saved my ass many, many times. Most people have this backwards. They spend a ton of time working in and watching their operating account and very little time with their second account, their reserve account. I'm going to now show you how to turn this thought process on its head. You will now learn how to spend very little time in your operating account and a lot more time in your reserve account. You might think it sounds so simple, duh, it's called a savings account. Well, you're kind of right. First of all, it is so simple, but hardly ever done. What really differentiates a reserve account from a savings account is how you think about it and use it. I'm going to show you exactly how to use the reserve account in a way that makes it much more useful than a regular savings account. The reality is that most of us don't want to bother with multiple bank accounts and don't have the backbone to say no to ourselves or others. Therefore, we only use one bank account and we fund it with all the income needed to pay our bills plus a little bit more. And we spend it all. Your operating account is the one in which the revenue, your paycheck, comes in and the expenses go out. This is the account that most people deposit all of their money into, and because of that, the money goes in and goes out within a very short period of time. This happens because we hate to say no to ourselves or others. We just have to have it, and we just have to have it now. We cook the cash each and every month, and we never get ahead. But that is not you. Not anymore, at least. Together, you and I have made the choice to get more money, and we start right now. The reserve account method does not require you to fight against this urge. In fact, this way you're free to spend every dollar in your operating account. Burn it up. With this method, I want you to cook the cash in it. Why? Because eventually your operating account will be on autopilot and your reserve account will be in place. The reserve account is where you want your attention. It's your security blanket, your armor, your protection. Now, the big question, how much of your income should go into your reserve account? The answer is simple. Every dollar above your monthly expenses should go into your reserve account. Figure out your monthly bills. You should have already done this. Make sure that amount of money goes into your operating account. Your monthly bills should include all of your monthly expenses. That means you should have a few bucks budgeted for your anniversary gift, the kids' birthday party, or even date night. I might also suggest that you have an emergency amount in place each month to help you be prepared for surprises, such as a broken stove or a flat tire. Next, set up all of your fixed bills, such as rent, mortgage, car payments, utilities, cell phone bill, etc., in your operating account on auto withdrawal each month. You should no longer be in the check writing business. Every bill should be automatically deducted from your account by ACH/auto withdrawal. This allows you to stay 100% focused on the two key components of this audio program, generating more revenue and funding your reserve account. Call the company you owe and have their monthly bill put on ACH. Some will set it up for you over the phone. Some will require you to go online to set it up. In either case, make it happen. Just set it and forget it. Your reserve account will quickly become your power account. I promise you with 100% certainty, if you get your operating account on autopilot and you get your reserve account set up and start funding it, everything in your financial world will change for the better. That sounds like something worth doing, doesn't it? Once your operating account is set up at your bank, go to a second bank, not the same bank that holds your operating account, and set up another account called a reserve account. You will now have two separate accounts, your operating account at one bank and your reserve account at another bank. Why two banks? Because I want it to be difficult for you to get to your reserve account. If you have both accounts at the same bank, you will be tempted to transfer your reserve to your operating account if you come up short. This can't happen. Your reserve account should not have checks or an ATM card connected to it. You must make it difficult to tap into. Your reserve account should only be tapped into for cash flow generating opportunities. It should never, I repeat, never be used for non-cash flow generating activities. It is not an emergency fund. It is not a secret stash. It is not a don't tell my spouse account. It is to be used to build you a nest egg that you will use when you have done your research and analysis on a future investment and pulled the trigger and invest. The only time you would dip into your reserve account is for a money-making opportunity you can't pass up. I'm talking about those opportunities that might only come along two or three times in your lifetime. Examples of this could be a piece of property that you could get for 60 cents on the dollar. Valuable stocks way down due to a recession. Special inventory for your business. The opportunity to buy a business on the cheap. The opportunity to invest with someone much wealthier than you. It should go without saying that before taking money out of your reserve account to fund an investment opportunity, you need to do extensive research and analysis to ensure you understand exactly what you're putting your money into. Now, how much should you have in your reserve account? The old adage was save 10% of your salary and you will retire poor, save 15% and you will retire middle class, and save 20% and you will retire rich. This is just not true. This may have worked for people at one time, but it won't help you now. None of these percentages matter. You are going to have enough money in your operating account to cover your monthly bills based on your budget, and 100% of the rest will go into your reserve account. Period. End of story. If you don't get this right, you will miss out. If you spend your life working off of one bank account in which all of your deposits and withdrawals go into it, odds are you will spend it all and you will never build wealth. Beware of the power of our brains to tell us that we can afford it, or that we can spoil ourselves, or that it's okay to spend it now because we have a big commission check coming in the next week. Giving in to these thoughts will kill your financial future. I want you to have the freedom your lifestyle by design creates. And if you follow my lead here and set up two accounts and fund them in the manner I described, you will be well on your way to making your lifestyle by design a reality. It's that easy. I promise. You just gotta set it up and execute on it. Don't spend your excess. As you make progress along your path to rich, you'll have a lot of opportunities to upgrade your lifestyle, but only some of them are really worth it. I'm a huge fan of flying myself around in first class. It is one of the few things that I think is a bargain. Why? Because it's a hedge against the cost of time. In other words, if I spend a few $100 more to fly first class, I pick up time. Less time in lines at security. Less time getting on and off the plane. In most cases, I'm off the plane and in an Uber on my way to a meeting before the last person in deep coach is even off the plane. This might save me 45 minutes, and that time is extremely valuable to me when I fill my calendar to the levels that I do with money-generating activities that more than make up for the cost of my flight. The additional room, comfort, and better service are just added bonuses, but few other upgrades pay for themselves in the same way. I could have traded in my Chevy Suburban for a Range Rover years ago, but I have three boys who play sports, and I have coached all of them and their friends for years now, and I don't want to worry about things like mud on the carpets of my Range Rover. I like things to be simple. I already have enough to worry about without having to worry about impressing people with showy upgrades. Trust me, at the end of the day, countertops are just something you cut on, floors are just something you walk on, and cars just get you from point A to point B. Once you are fully on purpose with your lifestyle by design, and because your money situation has improved, I challenge you to think less about the upgrades. They cost a ton, don't always bring back the value on resale that you paid for them, and often add aggravation to your life. Milestones of savings matter. Rocky and I married in October 1999. She loves to ask me, "What day did your life begin?" Because I always answer it with October 22nd, 1999. It's true. The day I married Rocky, my life as an adult really did begin. Prior to that, I was basically busted broke, trying to get a business off the ground without much luck for years. But I also was incredibly selfish and self-centered. I was out for me, and me only. In reality, I needed a push further than keeping food on my table and a roof over my head. When I married Rocky and we had our first son, Johnny Boy, in 2001, you can be damn sure that motivation kicked in and kicked in big time. Rocky showed me how to love unconditionally, and in return, I have wanted to provide her with financial security and a steady stream of a ton of income. My other half is my best half, and I was 1,000% committed to giving her a lifestyle by design. Our design. Unfortunately, for many years I didn't. My business started from zero in a one-bedroom apartment with a phone and a folding table, and it just wasn't going anywhere. It was a constant struggle to find more clients, hire more people, and make more profits. However, through all of the struggle, the hirings and firings, the lean years, I remember it like it was yesterday when I had $10,000 saved up. I called Rocky into the office and I showed her the bank statement of our reserve account, and it showed $10,000 in it. Free and clear, we had $10,000. We both looked at each other like it was all the money in the world. We just couldn't believe that we had saved that much money. We really had scrimped and saved. And look at what we had to show for it. We were committed to that $10,000, so we worked hard and smart. See, that $10,000 was the byproduct of having a reserve account. Without a separate reserve account, in which we put 20 to 40% of our gross income, that first $10,000 would have never happened. We would have spent it all. The $10,000 day is a day that I will never forget, because that $10,000 meant more to Rocky and me than the day that I had $1 million in that same reserve account. Why? Because when you come from broke, big numbers like $1 million seem like a pipe dream. Why else does the great financial guru Dave Ramsey say you need a starter fund of $1,000? Because it seems attainable to most people, and it is. And if you can reach small steps, maybe, just maybe, you can reach bigger steps as well. That was the same thing that happened to me when Rocky and I hit $10,000. It was the first time in my life that I actually thought I could accumulate some money. The problem was, as I have said and will continue to say throughout this audio program, it was too small a number. I was coming from broke, so $10,000 seemed like a lot, but I was wrong. As I said before, having $10,000 saved up was great, but in the big picture of earning and saving more, it was just a drop in the bucket. Now, if you are starting like I was, from zero, then $10,000 is a big accomplishment, but let's not lose focus of the primary message of this audio program. You need more money. I need more money. We need more money. And in order to get it, we are going to have to radically adjust the way we look at success. So while Rocky and I now had $10,000 saved up, I only celebrated for about 20 seconds, after which I turned up the heat and got back on the earning horse to get the number higher. You will need to do the same mental celebration followed by back to the grind over and over in your pursuit of money. I would love to say that you can take a small amount and turn it into a big amount, but the only way to do that is to crank up the heat and watch the milestones go by. You will need to hit the milestone of $10,000, followed by the milestone of $25,000, followed by the milestones of $50,000 and $75,000 and $100,000 and so on. The key is to crank up the heat and our revenue generating machine to a level that allows us to cross these milestones quickly. I put enough focus on increasing my revenue fast enough to blow past each milestone. And although I eventually got over the $1 million mark, it simply took me too long. Remember, I want you to kick the shit out of my success. I want you to win at the game of money faster and at higher levels than I did. Learn from my honesty here. Hit these milestones. Celebrate for just a few minutes and then get back to the massive effort to generate more revenue and hit the next milestone. Until you have more than $100,000 in your reserve account, don't even think about cooling off and celebrating for more than a few minutes. The goal must be to reach $100,000 as quickly as possible. What you will do with the $100,000 and the amounts above that is something that we'll tackle later. But for now, the minimum number that you must have in your reserve account before you celebrate is $100,000. Money is a lot like reaching your potential or achieving your goals. The only thing that happens is you realize you have more potential or more goals. The more money I make, the more it makes me realize how much more money I really need. Remember, most of our money goals and expectations are set by other people. Your goals need to be your goals, not goals set for you by someone else. How to know when you're rich and what to do when you are. How do you know when you're out of accumulation and into rich? When you no longer have to go to work to earn income to live the life that you have designed for yourself. This transition applies to the primary principle of you need more money. You need more money to live your lifestyle by design. Your lifestyle by design could be, I want to drive a truck for 6 months out of the year, and I want to hike the Appalachian Trail for the other 6 months. You're in rich when you have enough money to do that. You have reached your lifestyle by design. My version of rich is that I now have enough money to live the lifestyle that I have designed and I don't have to go to work every day for a paycheck. That road to rich is far more difficult than you think it is. The vision of surfing 6 months out of the year will 99% of the time be just that, a vision. Rich people get rich because they worked for it or inherited it. Good luck with that. They didn't limp into rich. The primary reason why people never get to rich is because they never carve out a path to get themselves there. They end up living a lifestyle by design created by someone else. But this will not be you because you are becoming a game facer. As I said before, living a lifestyle of your own design doesn't mean that you have to be the boss of your own company. I have multiple employees working for me who live incredibly rich, satisfied lifestyles. They have a clear vision of how they want to live. They generate plenty of income under the business plan that has been designed for them. They have absolutely none of the headaches that come from running a business. I take on those headaches for them. I'm the one that has to make sure the IT guy doesn't quit in the middle of the night and that someone shows up for work tomorrow. I'm the guy that has to create the surplus account to handle litigation. I have to deal with it all. You might ask, if I'm living a lifestyle by my design, why do I do all of that when I could easily hire someone to manage all of that for me? Because I enjoy being an entrepreneur, a problem solver, and part of my design includes being a leader to my team. You don't have to be the boss to get rich. You just have to figure out a few simple things. My friend Stanley is a perfect example of this. He's the guy who hosts the poker game I've been going to on the second Tuesday of every month for the past 13 years. Stanley is one of the rich guys I play poker with. Stanley is a game facer. Stanley grew up in the small town of Borger in West Texas. As he describes it, it's a horrible place. What made his adolescence in Borger even worse is that he was the only Jewish family. When asked, what was it like growing up as the only Jewish kid in Borger, Texas, he answers with, it really wasn't a bad place if you don't mind your senior yearbook being signed, Die Kike. I hope this puts an exclamation point on the fact that he really grew up in difficult circumstances compounded by daily anti-Semitism. West Texas in the 1940s and 50s, filled with racial slurs every day, was damaging. Stanley grew up with an effort to prove people wrong. He worked hard in high school, went to college, then continued to law school and became an attorney. He turned down large corporate offers by major oil and steel companies because he thought he had to do it on his own. He wanted to prove everyone wrong. He made the choice for himself by going into business for himself. Stanley Lattman, attorney at law, was the sign that he installed on his office door in gold leaf lettering. Stanley slowly built a practice, but he hated it. I've never met a practicing lawyer who's actually happy about what they do, and Stanley was no exception. Practicing law became a fairly unsatisfying platform for him. But the machine of life needed tokens, so he did what most of us do. He packed up his dreams, his full potential, and his superpower, and he just did what he had to do to pay the bills and support his family. Stanley built a law practice with over 10,000 divorces and hated all of them. Stanley tells this story of how his three children always knew they were expected to attend good colleges, but there was a catch. He told his children that he would pay for college and postgraduate studies. They would have no student debt at all unless they went to law school. If they did, they'd have to pay their own way. He was that adamant about how much he despised practicing law. Stanley saved what he earned because he was scared of not being able to pay it all off. Not just his kids' tuition, but the house, the bills, and the retirement. At one point, his family hadn't gone on vacation in 8 years. He drove a Mazda. All his lawyer friends and their Jaguars would make fun of him because they were starting to earn and spend while he earned and saved. Stanley was in accumulation mode, and he was stacking and racking cash. Then he finally decided he was going to build a new lifestyle by design. He knew that his law practice was only going to earn him so much money and he was never going to get rich from it. So he began to study, to conduct his research and analysis, and become very skilled at understanding the growth patterns of the city of Dallas. He leveraged his relationships and constantly asked people questions like, where is the population growth within the city of Dallas moving? Do you think that people will move north of the city or south of the city? Are there any plans to widen Interstate 75? What type of office space do you think business owners will want in the next 10 years? After he spent a few years in this research and analysis, he had his game plan. Executive offices would be needed on the north side of downtown Dallas along the I-75 highway. He went on the hunt for a building that he could move his small law practice into, renovate, rent out executive offices, and eventually sell. And that's exactly how it happened. He found that ideal building, bought it, and rented it out to 100% occupancy with a waiting list of tenants because the expansion of I-75 had started. And when the real estate funds came calling, Stanley was able to name his price and sell the building. Everyone wanted a piece of commercial real estate on I-75, and he was happy to sell his building to the highest bidder. Stanley, after getting out of broke, staying committed to accumulation, leveraging up his relationships for information, and doing his research and analysis to reduce the risk in his decision, was able to execute on his plan and move himself closer to the finish line of being rich. And he was able to soon cross that finish line. Because he had had a healthy reserve account, he was able to use it to buy the building. He was able to use this money to get closer to becoming rich because, if you remember, the reserve account is to be spent only on investments that can make you more money. Then the buyers came calling. Stanley sold his office building to a large investment company out of New York who made him an offer he couldn't refuse. It was a huge windfall for him. He played his hand perfectly. One day, at 55 years old, he put on his suit, went downstairs, had a cup of coffee, kissed his wife Lana on the cheek, and went to his office. He said hello to his secretary and his clerk and sat down at his desk just like he had done on thousands of other days. His phone rang. He looked at it, and then and there, he decided, "I'm not going to answer it." He said, "I'm done. I'm no longer going to practice law." He called in his small staff and said, "It's over. The cases we have will all be worked to the conclusion. Everyone will be paid until then. And as of today, we are no longer taking any new business." He went home that afternoon and his wife welcomed him, asking, "How was your day?" He said, "It was incredible. I retired today. We no longer have to live a lifestyle that is not by our design." Stanley went on to invest his money in the stock market. He became an extremely sophisticated stock trader, and in the past 20 years, his net income has quadrupled. Today, Stanley drives and buys whatever he wants. He and Lana vacation throughout the globe with an affinity for exotic cruises on the Seabourn Cruise Lines, the Ritz-Carlton of cruises. Stanley retired rich. He no longer has to go work to earn the income to live his lifestyle by design. He lives life on his own terms. Stanley's story isn't about investing money. It's about investing in himself, in his lifestyle by design. I want the same for you, to eventually not have to go to work to have the income to fuel your lifestyle by design. That is being enriched. The reason we already figured out your lifestyle by design is so you can understand how you finish rich. Action steps. Get into accumulation mode. Cut it out. You're done spending on anything else but your expenses. Once you're out of broke, feel free to burn up the money in your operating account, but only because you put the exact amount you need every month in there. Two bank accounts, two banks. This will help you not be tempted to move the money from your reserve account into your operating account. Do not touch your reserve account under any circumstances until you're ready to use it for investing to make more money. Get to $100,000. It's going to take a while, and you should definitely feel proud when you have saved the milestones along the way. But life and accumulation really start at $100,000, and it's only the beginning. You're only enriched when you have enough money to live your lifestyle by design without having to go to work every day for a paycheck. Keep your broke mindset. This will prevent you from getting too comfortable. Keep the heat on. You are not good. I'm in accumulation mode. This is your new mantra. and will explain to your family and friends why you're changing your spending habits. Chapter 6, step number 3, surround yourself with game facers. Don't go it alone. Most successful people work better on a team than alone. This is because the most successful people tend to do only one or two things at a superpower level. We'll figure out what your superpower is in the next chapter. Look at the yin and yang of some of the most successful names in recent decades. Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, Apple. Bill Gates and Paul Allen, Microsoft. Larry Page and Sergey Brin, Google. These are just a few of the tag teams of incredibly successful people whose talents complement each other. You want to find the yang to your yin. Find a partner you can trust, or a guru, or a mentor. The problem is, you may not always have that option. I didn't. I once heard Warren Buffett say, "Show me your hero, and I will show you how successful you will be in life." When you're figuring out whom to connect with or ask for guidance, ask yourself, whom do I admire? Can I do what they do? Do I trust them? Are they the right person to give me insight on who I am or who I could be? You wouldn't go to a marriage counselor who's been divorced 3 times, and yet we take money advice from people who have no money. You must find a money mentor. Someone who has already reached the financial level that you want, and then follow their lead. You need to find someone you can emulate. If you can't find them in person, find them in tapes, books, and videos. Since I never found a steady mentor or business partner, I turned to books, tapes, CDs, and videos. I have read, watched, and listened to thousands and thousands of them. That translates to thousands and thousands of hours searching and clawing to find assistance. Some of my favorite virtual mentors have become Tom Hopkins in sales, Tom Peters in management, and most recently Grant Cardone for sales training and Gary Vaynerchuk for social marketing. Here is a good checklist to make sure you are talking to the right people. Number 1. They must have something you want. Number 2, they must be more successful than you, i.e., if you want marriage advice, ask someone who has been married for 50 years. Number 3, they must be trustworthy. Number 4, they can't have chemical addictions of any kind, including alcohol. And number 5, they must be willing to help you with little in return for them. Simple, right? It may be harder than you think. It will take you a while to find a few such people, and even longer to find one who can be a mentor. That's okay. Be patient. Ask around. Keep looking. You'll find them. Aspire to your own success. Don't worry about others. Here's a question I'm guessing you've asked yourself several times. How on earth does that guy afford that? I've certainly asked myself this question in hundreds of situations. In my younger days, I asked that question with curiosity. There's a scene in the movie The Pursuit of Happiness when Will Smith's character walks up to a guy pulling up in a Ferrari and he asks, "What do you do for a living?" That was me. All the time. From the ages of 12 to 24, always searching for guidance on what career path I should take to earn money. I knew I wanted money, so I chose the hotel business to find my riches. It seemed exciting to me, the ability to run a hotel and be the big cheese. People would travel from all over the world to the hotel that I was in charge of. They would ask for the general manager, and I would drop in to greet them and answer any questions that they had. I would be the big boss who could make their dream trip come true. I pursued this passion. First by going to culinary school and then adjusting my degree to hotel restaurant management at Johnson & Wales University in Providence, Rhode Island. It was considered then, and still today, one of the best schools in the industry. I heard people say it was right up there with Cornell. Imagine that, me, a C&D student, going to a college that was right up there with an Ivy League school. Once I got there, I quickly learned that Johnson & Wales was where the poor kids went and Cornell was where the rich kids went. This turned out to be a good fit for me because I always looked at myself as the poor kid, fighting against the rich kids. This mindset has been a double-edged sword, and if I am 100% honest with myself, it hurt me financially. The chip I had on my shoulder against the rich kept me from asking for help, networking up, and in my deepest thoughts, made me feel inadequate, not up to par, less than them. I felt like the underdog, the outsider. It has fueled me to be better and push myself my entire life, and is perhaps the reason that I have achieved a level of financial success that puts me in the top 1% of the 1%. But still, I really should have a lot more money. It's this self-defeating mindset that made me believe that I had to do it on my own, my way. This kind of thinking, if used properly, can create success, but it will also hold you back. You want to maximize your success, and in order to do that, you need the help of others. And in order to ask for help, you first have to believe that you are worthy. You may not have the money of more successful people, but everyone starts from somewhere. One truth I've discovered is that most rich people want to help other people get rich. You just have to believe enough in yourself to have the guts to ask for the help. Don't wait as long as I did. Believe in yourself in all aspects of your life and ask for advice from people who have achieved more than you. You will be surprised how many of them will give you the answers you are looking for. While you should be on the lookout for successful people who can mentor and advise you, don't fall into the trap of comparing yourself to others and wondering what they think of you. Here's a more useful way to think about other people and their success. Number one, it's your life, not theirs. Stop keeping up with the Joneses and start keeping up with, insert your family name here. Your opinion of others is a waste of your time because they couldn't care less. The wealthiest people I know don't care what you think of them. The least wealthy people I know care a lot about what others think. Remove your judgment of others and increase your judgment of yourself. Number two, be happy for the success of others. When others succeed, you can learn. Spend time actually supporting the success of others by asking them how they did it. Number three, follow the money. Connect with people who have what you want. Ask your successful friends out to lunch. Tell them that you're in accumulation mode and that you want more money. Number four, attend conferences and workshops. You can connect with and learn of new developments and hear exciting ideas from the leading thinkers and practitioners in your industry by attending relevant conferences, workshops, and conventions. Better yet, if you've built some expertise, see if you can get invited to be a speaker yourself. Follow other people's money. I remember when I started to move up the food chain and follow the money. I started by asking the limited number of people I knew with money if they would help me. At first, I was bad at this because I was so hung up on my own insecurities and my low self-esteem. I believed that these more successful people would see that I wasn't as successful as they thought, and this mindset held me back. Remember our commitment to each other in this program. We are moving past fake and embracing reality. We are now awake and alive and in control of our money situation and no longer held back by our past. I started to have lunch with people on my dime, and I would literally say, I'm looking to network with highly successful individuals who can help me make more money. People were happy to take me up on the offer. The lunch appointments and opportunities opened me up to an entirely new world. One of the most valuable mentors I connected with was Norm Brodsky, a wealthy serial entrepreneur whom I met at an Inc. magazine program called Birthing of Giants. BOG is an entrepreneurial incubator of sorts that accepts only 60 applicants. I applied in 1999 and was accepted. The program lasted 3 years, and for 1 week each year, I would fly to MIT, yes, that MIT, and learn from the best minds anywhere. I felt so out of place, and I was afraid and confused when I got there. The other 59 students were way above me at that time. They'd accomplished incredible things, and it showed in their confidence and swagger. Meanwhile, it was 1999, and my business was only 4 years old. I was newly married to my sweetie Rocky, and I didn't have a pot to piss in. I remember putting the $2,000 fee and flight on my credit card because I didn't have the cash in my personal or company bank account. I don't regret spending the money, but I regret not making the best use of my time there. If I could do it all over again, the first thing I would have said when we went around the room doing introductions would have been, I don't have a clue why I'm here. I have no idea who read or didn't read my admission application, but you screwed up and gave my seat to the wrong person. Me! I'm totally outclassed and in over my head, but I'm hungry and I'm gritty and I'm honored to be here to learn from everybody. Instead, I stood up and made up some bullshit about how well my business was doing and that we were going to take over the equipment financing industry. I spent most of my time there trying to impress others instead of just learning. I could have learned so much at BOG, but wasted the opportunity and put very little of what I did learn into place when I got back, which must have cost me a decade of my success. But back to Norm. Norm was one of the speakers at BOG when I attended. He was raw and street smart. He even later wrote a book called Street Smarts. And I loved him and his message. He was all about common sense and was blue collar, which resonated with me. His message was a mixture of grit and hard work, but also of intelligence. He had a good common sense approach to his decision making, but because he was a CPA by trade, he combined this with a hard analytical look at the numbers. He made an incredible impact on me, but after the program ended in 2001, we lost touch. Fast forward 13 years to 2014, when my company made the Inc. magazine top 500, 5,000 fastest growing companies in America. And whom did I see on the speaker list at the awards banquet in Phoenix? You guessed it, Norm. I may have missed the opportunity to connect with him at BOG when I was young and foolish, but I wasn't going to miss another chance. I knew Norm was a cigar lover. So before I left Dallas, I bought him a $300 box of 6 very fancy cigars as a gift. I left the box at the front desk for him, and they were delivered to his room. I knew that he would love it, and maybe he would remember me from BOG all those years before. When I saw Norm and his lovely wife Elaine at the banquet, I went up to them and reintroduced myself. It was clear he didn't remember me. But he did get the cigars. It got me Norm's attention and some of his time. Norm, I need your help, I told him. I've had success since we last saw each other, but I know I'm capable of more. I'm trying to move up the food chain and make more money. I want to improve my network. Do you have any suggestions for me? He said, of course. Once a year I have a cigar and bourbon night at my home in New York City for 25 people. I want you to come to the next one. Boom! Connection made. He sent me the invite a few months later, and off to New York City I went. At that party, I once again showed my honesty and humility and asked people, who do you know in Dallas that I should meet? One of the other guests said, you have to meet my friend Rick Sapio. He's a Dallas guy, and I will connect you. Boom! Another connection. An email introduction was made, followed up by lunch and subsequent personal visits, and Rick and I have since become great friends. He has helped me tremendously. He has also introduced me to a few select people, and as a result, I am now an investor in a private equity fund that invests in high-tech healthcare companies. This fund might turn out to be the best investment I have ever made and has helped me make more money and more connections. Why? Because I dropped the BS, stopped lying to myself and to others, and started to get honest and ask for help. I'm begging you, follow my lead and do the same in your life. Talk to people with proven and verifiable success. Ask for advice. Follow their lead. Model what they do and learn from them. Don't just let the answers to your questions pass you by, and certainly don't be phony about any of your experiences. Just keep asking questions and take action on the answers. Learn from experts. Question: why is it that every top athlete has a coach, but most business people don't? Answer: while athletes are focused on developing their skills, most business people don't think they need to, and so they never make it out of mediocrity. Whatever your line of work, you can only reach the pinnacle of your career if you focus on mastering your craft. You are still, sorry to say, an amateur. Today, experts get paid, while amateurs get crushed. Developing more skills in business is not something you can do without if you want to reach your maximum level of success. When the chips are down, it is your skills, your mastery, and the confidence that comes from that mastery that give you the grit to fight another day. It's also how you make the most money. You need to put in the time and effort to understand every aspect of how business works, or you risk getting burned. Understanding business in today's world means more than just owning a business. It means you need some sort of expertise in everything from sales, legal, insurance, licensing, and accounting, to marketing, social media, human resources, information technology, and more. Even if you're not going to be an expert in everything, you can borrow knowledge from the experts who are, and therefore deliver more value to your company and your clients. Whether you are an employee or an employer, you need to learn everything you can about everything that impacts your industry and how to make the industry work for you. And while you need to rely on stellar employees or coworkers so you don't have to do every job on your own, that does not mean you have the luxury of not knowing how every job works. You increase your value when you acquire more knowledge, and we'll talk more about how your value earns you more money in Chapter 8. So, for example, while you may not be interested in what the IT department does, or you don't think it impacts your career because you work in marketing, if you know more about how IT works and how it affects your marketing efforts, you become exponentially more valuable. Ask to sit in on the IT meeting. Take the IT manager to lunch. Start Googling, how does IT affect marketing? I promise you, one of the easiest ways to increase your value within your company is to spend just 10 minutes a day talking to people and researching the areas that you don't directly control. An important factor here is not to become bothersome. Just open your eyes and ears and file the knowledge away for a later date. You don't need to start interfering in other people's jobs or announcing your half-baked ideas on how they could do it differently. You want to learn how it all works, not how to do it all, and you want to be humble when asking for information. When I started at Hilton Hotels in 1991, I learned this the hard way. I was the rookie in the sales department trying to make a name for myself. I was a hotshot who at 22 years old wanted to learn it all and would come in earlier than everyone and stay later. I would come in on Sundays and watch how the restaurant worked. I would stay late and talk to the bellman and see how he would greet the guests by name by looking at their luggage tags. I would work out in the hotel gym to talk to the health club manager, and I would lean on the front desk and listen to how the conversation went when a guest was checking in. This all was cool to me, and I quickly got noticed as a good guy, as a hustler. But then I started to open my mouth. I would say to the bellman, "Hey, here is a list of the companies I work with. If you see one of their reps check in, let me know." I would do the same for the gym manager and the front desk clerk. Then one day one of the bellmen said, "Screw you, Monero. You're not my boss. Get the hell out of my way." Shortly after that, the front desk manager asked to see me and she said, "I liked you at first, but now I see that you really don't know your place. You don't tell my staff anything. Nothing. Zero. And a word of advice. When you want to say something, you should go back to your little cube and start making more cold calls. She was 100% right, and I never forgot it. Even now, when I feel myself opening my mouth and speaking when it doesn't belong, I get my ass back to my desk and play to my strengths. Get on the phone and start making money.